This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I will be talking to Thomas Lane about his book, Karma Factor, and I'm looking forward to that because well, it is a fascinating book, and he has some deep insights into the current situation in the world. So I'm looking forward to that. But right now, my karma is I have back on Joy on Paper. After she was here just recently, and I never get tired of having her. She could come. As a matter of fact, several of my listeners have recommended that she become a co-host here on Joy on Paper. Leslie Carroll, hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. You know, I was listening to your theme song again, and I keep thinking it reminds me of, imagine if you had a Hollywood movie and you've got F. Scott Fitzgerald racing to get a script to Maxwell Perkins in time. Oh. And I never told you how much I love your theme song. It just, it's fun. It's joyful. It's you.
It's me. I start laughing. I start smiling. I start typing. And every time
makes me smile every time I hear your theme song.
And it's funny. Every time I have guests in the studio, they're typing along with me. You know, it's just, it has that theme. And I love the idea of F. Scott Fitzgerald because, you know, he was here in our area. We have a beautiful, beautiful hotel, the Don Cesar Hotel. It's one of those gorgeous big pink hotels, and it opened back in the 1920s, and he and Zelda were invited to come and open the hotel. And,
wow.
Well, you know, of course, with Zelda.
Did he dance in the fountain?
Well, more than that, it was really, of course, the hotel was just opening and everything wasn't even organized yet. It was like just before the opening day and it was really exciting. And Zelda, they already had the baby. The baby was with them. And it's right on the beach here, you know, on our glorious beach, wide white beaches. And there she was out there at night dancing naked.
I can just imagine.
In the moonlight.
I can just imagine. F. Scott Fitzgerald and I share a birthday. He's a little bit older than I am, of course. But I've always had a soft spot for him. And The Great Gatsby is one of my favorite novels. And it's one of the ones that I read every single year. There are three novels that I try to read every year. The Great Gatsby, The Sun Also Rises, and Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. And I just think of them as kind of the three perfect novels in terms of creation, plot, and character. And it's just, they're wonderful. But I every time I walk by the Plaza Hotel in New York, of course, I think about Scott and Zelda, and Zelda supposedly, you know, frolicking in the fountain in front of the Plaza Hotel.
Well, if you ever come down to our area, which you should, because it's so beautiful, you have to stay right there at the Don Cesar Hotel and ask them for the suite where they stayed, and it would be the perfect location for you.
I'd love to, and I absolutely promise never to frolic naked on the beach. Firstly, for one thing, it would horrify my husband, but there's certain things that aren't going to be shown in public.
But you can sit. They have these lovely swings that look out at the beach, and you can just I go there sometimes, you know, I just get a drink, and I sit on the swings, and I just swing back and forth, looking out at the beach and imagining how much fun Zelda had there.
I love swings. They used to. I used to cut gym when I was in high school, and this is how I became. I don't know if I ever told your listeners this. This is how I became a fabulous cold reader as an actress, and that's my favorite auditions is just to do a cold read. I hate monologues. I think they're just kind of an unnatural way to assess an actor's talents. But either I would go to the library instead of gym with my best friend, and we would just pull a play out of the stacks and cold read it, or I would go to the lower school, the grade school, and just go on the swing. And that was my idea of gym class.
A perfect idea. If I love it.
Of course. It. Isn't that exercise? I think it's exercise.
Well, swings have played a very important part in my life. Of course, we had a swing on my porch, and I also had a hammock. I practically lived my summers in a hammock reading.
I love those. My parents have one in their summer weekend house. And it's actually a great way to lie down and come up with creative ideas to do things. And the swings, those famous, the Fragonard or Boucher, the woman on the swing, the set of the Four Seasons. They're at the Frick Museum now in New York. But now I think about, you know, Marie Antoinette and those wonderful pastoral scenes with the women on the swings and their poofy dresses and all of that, and all of that pink and green. And
oh, yeah. And, of course, they'd have flowers, and it was beautiful.
Yes, and courtiers pushing them in the swing. Love it, love it.
Love it.
Now I am mired deep in vocabulary research for all of these French words, and there are a whole lot more than I thought there were, because I have to go through every single one of them, because a week from today, I go into the audio book narration booth at Tantor Audio and to narrate the second and third of the Marie Antoinette trilogy. The first one I narrated when the books first came out. So now, a decade later, I'm finally getting to narrate the dream job.
Oh, it's going to... I'm looking forward to that. But you just went
so
through a whole series here where month after month, you released a new book.
Yes, month after month. And then they waited for some reason, which I don't know because no one told me, and I didn't think to ask because you're not supposed to ask these kind of questions. The final book of the... it was the first one that came out. When these royal books, nonfiction royal books, the series of loves and lives of European royalty and all their faults and foibles and all of that, all of the royal books I wrote, Royal Affairs, Notorious Royal Marriages, Royal Pains, Royal Romances, and Inglorious Royal Marriages, which is the schadenfreude of all really bad ones, those were written between 2007... and 2014, I think. And then finally, Berkeley, when Random House, they were written for a Penguin imprint. And over the years, as time marched on, Penguin and Random House merged, you know, Pac-Man, they ate each other. And they merged. And now the books are one of the Random House imprints. And they decided, let's bring her back into the audio booth. So now finally, they are audiobooks. And they were recorded out of sequence for I don't know what reason. But the first book that I wrote, which was Royal Affairs, was the last book to be recorded, and they released them month by month by month. So the last one to have dropped was just in time for the December holidays. That was Notorious Royal Marriages. And Royal Affairs, for some reason, will be released on the vernal equinox, March 21st. I don't know why there was a three-month gap, but who knows. But what's wonderful for people who love audio is that because so much time has passed between the time the books were written and the time that I stepped into the booth to tell the story, things have happened. Like Charles became king and he's no longer Prince of Wales, and some of the laws have changed for the British monarchy, and they discovered Richard III's body, so now we know that he really actually had scoliosis, and it wasn't Shakespeare inventing his hump and all of that. So I got to update some of the material. So all of the new stuff, even if you have the paperback and you like to read along with and listening to the audio, or you're listening to the audio and the car or the supermarket or the bathtub or, you know, wherever you enjoy audiobooks, you get to have anything that's been updated where new material has come along.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I love listening to audiobooks, and particularly your voice. I mean, you have
Thank you.
A wonderful voice. Of course, being an actress, it was natural to you, and you've done a lot of audiobooks for other people over the years.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. It was very interesting because I hadn't met a lot of these people when I started recording the nonfiction for a company I hadn't worked with before, and it was sort of embarrassing because they thought, oh, well, you know, she's just the writer. She's just recording her own books. And I'm like, no, I have a whole career. I've done this for other people before. I even won. They have these awards. They're called Audie for audio, or Audie Murphy for those who remember who the heck he was. They're called Audie Awards for audio. And I won one for narrating a woman's nonfiction book about a very famous grifter from the 19th century, and I had a million accents in it and all of that, and I hadn't even met her at the time. I didn't know these people, so I had a whole career narrating, I still do, narrating other people's work, and I kept saying, why won't they hire me to narrate my own work? I do this. And I love it because it marries my acting career and my writing career, and especially with the nonfiction. The editor who hired me to write those books wanted the books written with a certain tone. She didn't want it to feel like, oh, it's another dry, dusty history book. She wanted it written with a very ebullient, fun tone, a sort of a, come on, pull up a chair. I've got a really great story to tell you about Anne Boleyn. You know, you think her sister was the bad one? Well, you know, or actually Anne Boleyn's sister was really quite a hoot. She was quite raunchy and sexy. But these books tell the real story, the facts. So for people who are interested in The Crown or all of these miniseries about Victoria, or God help us, there's another one coming out about Marie Antoinette, and I have a friend who's been texting me, and she's watching this new Marie Antoinette miniseries, and I said, keep saying, kill me now, this didn't happen, this didn't happen. And she's like, did such and such really happen? Did she really do this? I'm like, no, she didn't. So it drives me crazy. So, you know, read my books, and you can listen. You'll listen to the Marie Antoinette stories that from my novels are heavily based on the historical record, but we get inside Marie Antoinette's head. And this poor girl who at age 14 had to leave her family behind forever and marry a guy that she'd never met before. And in preparing the stuff for the final book in the series, I don't know how I'm going to get through it as I read it, because I was crying. I mean, I hope I can make my listeners cry, but I kept grabbing Kleenex just as I was writing down the vocabulary words. I had to stop, and I'm marking up the words, and this is how I want to read it, and this is how I want to get inside their heads, and I thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to get through this?
Well, I know the feeling, because I cried when I read that one.
It's tough. I mean, obviously your listeners are all smart enough to know that anybody who lived between 1755 and 1793 is dead by now. We all know. But it's a tough story.
It is. It is. And when you've been to Paris and where you have stood on the spot, and I did the walk, you know, the mm-hmm. exact route. And you stand on that spot, and my husband didn't know a lot about French history, and certainly not about the kings and the queens. And so when I took him on that walk, I said, we're going to follow the exact walk. And mm-hmm. when I got to that spot, I am bawling. I'm just crying. And that happened when I was reading the book, because you do write so beautifully.
Thank you so much. I mean, I kept making myself notes in the margins as I'm working on this, and it is what I meant what I intended to do as I wrote the book, is to bring the readers along the journey. You are there, you are in Paris, you are in Versailles. As the listener and as the reader, I want people to be alongside these characters. I don't want them to feel like... When I was in second grade, they used to take us to the Museum of Natural History on Central Park West, and they had these, you know, these little clay figures or carved wood in a diorama, and you used to look in the diorama at these little figures that didn't move, that were covered with dust, that had been there for how many decades, and how many second graders had seen them over the years on a class trip, and you felt very removed. You were looking at them through glass. And you were looking at them because your teacher made you. It wasn't, history didn't come alive. These figures didn't move or breathe. And I thought, oh, God, I don't want to be that writer. And I know there are novelists who feel like there should be a remove from these characters, but I want my readers and my listeners to be in that room or be outside and, you know, smell all the different perfumes or the perspiration or the fresh air or whatever it is. And if you're jostling elbow to elbow or whatever, or to be as horrified as I was that the French revolutionaries massacred priests and orphans, and they just, the bloodlust became so insane. They lost control of the narrative. I mean, the idea that they wanted a voice in their government makes perfect sense. But how is wanting a voice in your government equated with massacring everybody they saw?
And there can never be a riot that doesn't get out of control.
Of course,
violence,
of course.
You start with one little thing, throwing a rock, and then you have thousands of rocks, and then other things, and the violence grows. And what they did when you're there, you know, as I spent a lot of time there, and it would be so heartbreaking to think, well, and really, literally, you could walk street to street and say, here, this place was filled with blood. This is where they...
Yeah, the streets really did run with blood. It wasn't a metaphor.
No, it wasn't. And
what's interesting is that we think about some of the American revolutionaries, and supposedly the French Revolution was modeled on the American Revolution, but it wasn't. Mm. Our streets did not run with blood. It was army against army, really. It wasn't, you know, or army against our own revolutionaries. They misinterpreted the memo.
Yes, it's definitely. And I love the whole Marie Antoinette series. I remember years ago when I first went to the Louvre, and I went, and you know, where they have the clocks, you know, and I think, wow. It was so beautiful, and it was so sad what happened to her. And I think your the way you looked at her, the way you investigated her, the way you bring her out is so beautiful and so I think true. Unfortunately, as you said, they always make these movies, but so often they're making movies based on old movies of.
Instead of getting this fresh material. It's like a game of telephone where bad history gets repeated. And I saw a commercial or the trailer for this new miniseries where they're like, well, this is going to be the feminist version of Marie Antoinette.
Oh.
Well, I mean, I would like to consider myself a feminist, but Marie Antoinette was not a, quote, feminist. She wasn't a feminist. And then they have her... I saw the trailer where they have her kissing another woman who I assume was one of her ladies-in-waiting. But she didn't! But that plays right into all of the propaganda that claimed that Marie Antoinette was having affairs with her ladies-in-waiting. No, she didn't! Marie Antoinette was not a, quote, liberated woman. She was, I just wanted to throw things at the television set. She was an absolute traditionalist. She was faithful to two men, her husband and Axel von Fersen, and she loved them in different ways. And the only way I can equate it, and I do in the novel, is sort of like the Lancelot Guinevere Arthur triangle. Is you have this man, and in a way, Axel von Fersen, who was this Swedish count who was in some ways an erstwhile, because he was Swedish, not French, courtier to the French royal family, and he did serve as a mercenary in the American Revolution. He was an aide-de-camp to General Rochambeau and served as his translator when Rochambeau negotiated with George Washington at Yorktown. It's a fascinating history. But Fersen was in love with Marie Antoinette. They were in love with each other, and Fersen represented the dashing, bold soldier and man of action, and he was brilliant and spoke several languages. And Louis was, you know, the husband that she was bound to at the age of 14, and who they really had nothing in common except their children. And there was kind of the man that she was married to was the king, and the man who stirred her heart. Well, so it's very much like Guinevere and Lancelot, Guinevere and Arthur. There's that triangle. When that actually comes from the French Crétin de Troyes romances of the French Renaissance. So
well,
there's that kind of dynamic.
It's nice that you're in New York City again. It's easy for you to go over to the studio and record these.
I know. I'm very lucky, because the 6.5 years that we were in Denver for my husband's job, and I am ever grateful to his fabulous boss for letting us move back to New York, because I have aging, ailing parents, and it was very difficult to be across the country from them. They live in the Bronx, where I grew up. And now I can just run to doctor's appointments for them or the hospital where they have treatment and stuff. And now I can go to what I need to for go to the studio and stuff like that. But they are allowing my husband to work from home here.
That's great, because, as you said, it's wonderful for you to be there for your family. And we mentioned last time we started to talk about the Algonquin Hotel and about your father. So tell us something about
My grandfather.
Your grandfather.
My mother's father, his name was Carol Carroll, and he de-Judified it when he was 20 years old. He was born Carol Weinschenk, which is German for wine steward. But there was a lot of anti-Semitism as he was growing up. Also, it's a name, it's very hard to spell and pronounce. And he was had bylines in the New Yorker. My understanding, I mean, he was born in 1902, so he's sadly long gone now. My understanding is that he was a member of the Round Table with, of course, Robert Benchley and the great Dorothy Parker. And I wish that I had known when I was younger to really bend his ear on that, because I was fascinated by that. He was a humorist, and he would write movie reviews. And when he got his first byline, Carol Weinschenk was not going to fly, and it was spelled Carol with two R's and two L's, like the actor Carol O'Connor. And he thought Carol Carroll. Well, nobody's going to forget that name. And he started also writing comedy, and for the early days of vaudeville, and then for sort of a precursor to your show of shows with the early comedians. And there's a wonderful scene in the movie My Favorite Year where there's a John Barrymore type character, and there's a story that my grandfather told about being this sort of cub reporter type, where his job is to keep John Barrymore sober and away from the women so that he can be there, bring Barrymore in for the big radio broadcast so that he's sober and can do this monologue from Hamlet. But my grandfather used to take me to the Algonquin when he was meeting with his editor. Much later in life, he wrote a memoir about his life as a radio writer. And when the title of it is wonderful, because when you say somebody, "Oh, what's the name of your book?" And his answer was, "None of your business." because that's the name of my grandfather. The title of my grandfather's book was published by Putnam, and you can probably find a copy on, God knows, eBay or something. It was published by Putnam in 1972 or something, 70, 71, titled None of Your Business, or Confessions of a Renegade Radio Writer. And it's a lot of fun, and it tells these fabulous anecdotes about what it's like to be a young man writing for Eddie Cantor and all of this stuff, and how Eddie Cantor wouldn't accept my grandfather's jokes because Eddie Cantor thought Eddie Cantor was a better writer than this young guy. And so when my grandfather was meeting, his editor was a guy named William Targ, who was, who knew when I was in my 20s, you know, or teens, this guy's a hotshot editor. So I'm meeting with my grandfather. My grandfather says, well, you know, this is my granddaughter and young actress, and I don't even remember at that point if I thought about being a writer. But my grandfather, at his knee, taught me how to write poetry and the constructs of, this is a sonnet, and this is what the meter and the rhyme should be in a sonnet. And because Cyrano de Bergerac was my favorite play, and a ballade is the big construct where there's a great sword fight in the first act of, you know, a ballade. He said, okay, I'm going to teach you how to write a ballade, and this is the construct, and how many verses, and where the meter and the rhyme, and da-da-da. My grandfather taught me that. He taught me how to write. I was interested in writing reviews of movies or plays just for the fun of it. Okay, this is how you do it. He taught me to get rid of superfluous words, and I still think of that. Very, really, were nice words. He said words that don't mean anything. But it was such a treat to sit in the Rose Room, was where he met his editor, at the Algonquin, and I felt just as I would when my grandmother took me to the Plaza Hotel for tea, like Eloise at the Plaza. I felt like Dorothy Parker at the Algonquin. I'm like, I am in a temple to literature. I have stepped back God knows how many years. Maybe I was precocious. Maybe it's growing up in New York City, but maybe I was born in the wrong decade. I don't know.
Oh.
But it's just so wonderful, and I think it's changed a lot since the last time I was in the Algonquin. Was I had met somebody who wanted me to read a small part in something for him. It was a script I read, and stepping back into the Algonquin felt wonderful, but I think they'd redone some of it, and I just missed my grandfather so much.
Yeah. I love the Algonquin, and That's where I go when I come to New York. So we're going to meet there for tea. And
absolutely.
Okay. As I said, I could have you on for hours. I could have you on every day.
I know. I think it would be fun to be your co-star. Speaking of, my grandfather ultimately became a ghostwriter when he was, quote, retired in his 70s, 60s. He was a ghostwriter for celebrities' autobiographies. And he was a ghostwriter. He was Ed McMahon's ghostwriter, speaking of sidekicks on talk shows.
It would be so much fun, but I think you take over because you're a born star, and it's always a joy to talk to you. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. You've just made my day. You've just made it so wonderful. And I'll have you back again soon. As soon as you finish the Marie Antoinette, you have to come back and talk about it.
Absolutely. I should be finished. I should be. I think it's going to take longer than they think it's going to take. The books are longer than they think. And they'll be horrified when they see how many pages of vocabulary words there are. They expect me to finish on Valentine's Day, so, and I don't know when they will release them, but I will let everybody know.
You know, the anniversary of Joy on Paper, the 8th anniversary of Joy on Paper, is going to be March 17th, so perhaps
St. Patrick's Day.
You can be on that program. How about that?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Let me look at
okay.
my...
I'll let you know.
Oh, wait, you know something? I'll be out of town. March 17th, I'm going to Boston to do, I'll be doing research
week,
on...
Maybe the week before to promote the new book
anniversary. March 17th, I will be researching my Louisa May Alcott in Boston.
Whoa. Okay. Well, that's exciting, too. We'll have you on in March so we can talk some more. And my listeners, now my listeners are going to be happy. They're going to say, well, finally, you listen to us. And I got Leslie Carroll on today, and thank you so much.
I love your listeners. You have the best listeners ever.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Have fun. All right, we're going to go straight over to my guest. I think my guest is on the phone. My guest is not on the phone. Okay. Hold on a minute. Let's play the commercials, I guess.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Thomas Lane, and the name of his book is The Karma Factor. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, well, whew, what a book.
Oh, yes, thank you.
This is, it's so fascinating, and I want to say the part about set in New York. I love New York, and I was just talking to an author who lives in New York City, and she's so happy to be back living in New York City. So those parts that you write about New York City are so, so very, very good. You really capture the city.
Oh, I fell in love. I lived there a couple different times, and, you know, it was the place to be. It was home. It was exciting. I was younger in those days, but yeah, it's a magic city.
Well, the karma factor. When I started the book, of course, you have at the very beginning, well, first two things. You've dedicated it to everyone who's facing a crazy world crisis, and I thought, well, that's rather apropos to the occasion.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, I don't know, when you finished writing this book, I don't think things were quite as bad as they are now.
That's probably true. You know, I wanted to thank you for your title, you know, Joy on the Paper, because to use a word like joy in this time is really, it's wonderful. I think it's, and because, you know, somehow, I don't know, I get the feeling that, you know, I can't feel joy because so many things are so wrong. But anyway, I appreciate it. you're naming that.
Well, you know, I came out with the idea for this program at 4:15 one morning, and my reason for using that name is I find so much joy, not just in writing, but also the joy of reading.
Yes.
Because it can take us out of ourselves. It can take us to good places. It can take us to crazy places. It can take us into a world where even that even if the world that is being written about might not be as bad as the world we're existing in. It's like during the pandemic, people really needed to read about something to take them from thinking about the pandemic. Now, whoa. Your book is great. You know what I love, first of all, your main character. I'll let you explain it, but I thought, you know, always when people come out with a character and they want to, who's going to really carry the book through, that James Early is a fascinating character that you've developed. And tell us, the book has many different aspects. So how do you like to explain this book? Because we start off with a very, you know, the story we're reading. I love when things are revealed slowly or when things develop. So we start off and we're just a very nice bedroom scene, sort of a typical bedroom scene that could be real. And it has been played over and over, but then things just... we're learning a lot about your character, James Early. So tell us about him.
Well, he is, when we start out, he is just really under sort of mental collapse there. He is, you know, he's not seeing the world. He knows there's something wrong inside him. At one point, he says to his partner, he says, I just wish, I know I did something horrible. I don't know what it is. I wish somebody would just tell me what it is and put me in jail. And, you know, he doesn't know. He's been blocking out this past that he has. And even when he, you know, stands, puts himself in the middle of a hail of machine gun fire just so he can, like, end it all, suddenly the bullets are diverted. And then now he has to, this is, I don't know if you've read the Robert McKee book about story, but it's called The Inciting Incident, where, you know, the main character is flung into the unknown and somehow he has to scramble his way back to a new place. And this is what happens to Early. All of a sudden, things collapse. The way he's used to perceiving the world, his terrible opinion of himself, he begins to, through the course of the book, he begins to find out what's going on with him, where he has been, what he's acting out, in a sense, and he begins to take responsibility and accountability for, you know, a huge mistake in the past. I don't know if that answers your question. But the book then reveals the layers of awareness that he's going through, and that is, he's part of a kind of a master plan by some folks that are very wise and all-seeing.
Well, of course, he's a cop in New York City. So we have that aspect. We get to know him, his family, where he comes from. Now, at the very beginning of the book, you have a letter. You know, one of the times I remember really losing it when I was watching a television program. It was years ago. I was in England, and they showed the story about the Chinese blowing up the Buddhist monasteries.
Yeah.
These gigantic places with these people who were peaceful. And they just blew them up.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that there could be people so evil.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Does this letter come into it, and how does the whole idea of karma, where did you find this idea?
Let's see. The letter is the very, very big picture, which is, you know, I don't want to give it away too much, but is a renegade monk who sees, who believes in past lifetime, who sees after World War II, he looks sort of through his very vast perspective, and he sees a world that's in trouble, and that even when Hitler's defeated, another strongman, another, you know, dictator-type person will come into play, and we have seen that. And so he is trying to avert that by tackling what he considers the what's really going on is bad karma. Karma being sort of the cause, spiritual cause and effect of things. So that, and he's trying to approach, you know, solving just massive failures as you know, people that walk around with horrible things that have been done to them and done to the, you know, that they have done in the past, and cleaning them up. So this is the big picture, the big roadmap. And then we go down into, you know, the hands-on and how it's being worked out. My relationship with karma and spirituality really came, I have basically kind of a two-track thing. When I was a kid, I was raised in a very intellectual family, Harvard, Yale, and all that, and I just was not, I just didn't relate to that. And when I was feeling, you know, sort of as an outsider, I don't know if I developed it, but I had this vast imagination. So I would take, you know, take relief and escapism through this imagination. And then at a certain point, I couldn't hold it all away. The imagination wasn't always working to protect me. But then I ran into The Hobbit. My fourth grade teacher read The Hobbit out loud, and I was transfixed on this other kind of alternative reality of fantasy and literature and the joy of reading and turning the imagination into that. That turned into spiritual quest and trying to understand the world, trying to understand myself. At the same time, I was very much a guy. You know, I love sports. I love action adventure. I love, you know, this kind of competition among guys and stuff. So when I came to, you know, maybe in my 20s and 30s, these two things, this two as a regular guy and a spiritual quester and imaginative creative thing, they began to combine in a kind of opposing vectors inside me, but that was the impetus for creation. And I began writing and playing the guitar and singing and getting involved in progressive movements and stuff. So when I ran into the concept of the Akashic Records, which is how I termed at that point as a database of past lifetimes, I thought, how interesting, and how I could perhaps weave together this sort of database of past life, of everybody's incarnations being expressed in this database. It's you know, it's nothing you can see. It's not a real thing in terms of the physical plane. But anyway, so I, knowing that it's, or you know, it's, the world is gritty and tough and hard, but also there's magic woven in between the seams. And so the thought of an action adventure story and a with spiritual, sort of backlit by spiritual concepts and stuff, put them together, and this is how the karma factor was born.
Well, I love that you, when you're talking about your teacher reading The Hobbit, that you say the joy of reading.
Yeah.
Because I think that's so important for people to now understand this concept of joy. When you're joyful, it is so wonderful. You are feeling so good. You have energy and strength and power. And then, as we now know, I mean, the world is in crisis. And
yeah.
I don't understand a lot of it myself. I think part of it is people didn't perhaps believe that there was so much evil, and
yes.
The evil that we're seeing is something that I think this generation certainly wasn't prepared for.
Yeah, it's been, denial is I consider it like a drug, and it is very contagious, and it's very much rampant in our culture, where things that could have been noticed, the beginnings of things centuries ago, or decades ago anyway, and that there were problems and that we needed to face them. And the longer we don't face them, sort of the bolder it gets. And so now we're in a period of real transformation. And, you know, big lies and stuff like that. But I'm with you, because it's also a time of big truths. And people are really mobilizing and working things through interpersonally. I mean, there's a whole nother movement going on, which is, I feel, is based on joy, based on the miracle of life. And, you know, there are us that want to promote that. I sure do. I want to be out there talking about hope, despite all reasons not.
Because when we're looking at things today, and we can see, and we can actually identify some of the evil people in this world. I mean, we knew what Putin was.
Yeah.
There's no question that we knew. And all of this carnage that's happening is so, I think, so stunning for those of us, particularly for those of us who lived in Europe and traveled in Europe and traveled to these countries, have been in these countries, and that this would happen in 2022, 2023, it really, really takes a lot of, I don't know, you have to sort of control yourself, your mind, to get your hands around it.
Yeah. You know, I'm with you there also. You take your joy where you can get it. And if you know, I would rather have, you know, what is the phrase? I'd rather love and lost than never to have loved at all. And to be alive is to suffer, but it's also to find joy and truth and happiness. And so, again, it's like the opposites, you know, seem to be colliding in a way that is unmanageable. But that's the work, at least for me, that I have to do interpersonally and with myself and my work. And there's a lot of growth. I have found I am learning so much so quickly. This is really a growth spurt.
Now, the Karma Factor, of course, is available online and hopefully in bookstores. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes, please visit me at thomaslane.com. That simple. There's a lot of stuff about the book. I'm also a musician, and I've written poetry, and I'm a painter, and I'm all over the place. But it's largely devoted to the book, so yeah. Come check it out.
Did you do the cover?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
My wife and I did.
It's very good. It's very, I like it very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I took a look at it and I said to myself, that's an artist, and I really like it. It's great.
Thank you.
Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. I hope that people will get the book. It has so much depth and so much analysis. And I think it will help people to focus perhaps on what they can do and perhaps understand a little bit about what's going on in the world. But Thomas Lane, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And again, the name of the book is The Karma Factor, a fascinating book, a great read. Thank you very much, Thomas.
Thank you, and thank you for doing this work. It's really fun. It's really great.
Well, you know, I'm here to promote writers and to promote books, because I think it's so important that read. One thing I've discovered, that listeners to the program, they relate to a book better if they've heard the author talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They become interested in it, and that's what I love. I will get emails from people saying, well, I wasn't going to read this book, or I never heard of this book, but you know, the writer sounds so interesting. And as I want to tell people again, anybody who loves books that really do feature great parts of New York City, they will love to read this book. Again, Thomas, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thanks so much. Take care, everyone.
Okay.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Wow. All right. I skipped commercials today. I'm sorry, but I will talk about a few things. Because I have one of the things, of course, Larson & Larson. Bill Larson is going to be on the program in February, and we're going to be talking about intellectual property. And there have been some interesting intellectual property questions happening. One of the things I want to mention is Sue Grafton was a guest on Joy on Paper a number of times before she passed away. And I had just discovered that they are pirating some of her books. And if you see a book that is being sold that looks like it might be a pirated Sue Grafton, please don't buy it and report it to her Facebook page. Her family keeps her Facebook page on because I guess people think, well, she's gone and we'll just go ahead and pirate books. And of course, that is a bad thing to do. And it's something that all of you writers have to think about and make sure that you watch if your books are being pirated, because they're getting crazier and crazier, these scammers and these people who are too lazy to write a book themselves, and they're just happy to steal a book. And again, recently another listener and writer told me how her book was stolen, and it's always difficult. But one of the things is Bill Larson will tell us about how to protect your books, how to protect your intellectual property, and he will be on. And then, of course, EHS. You know, if you are so many people, I don't even want to talk about my electric bill this month, because this month is going to be terrible. I know that. And I'm sure it's yours, too. So if you can save money with solar energy, go EHS. Go to their website. It's goehs.com and find out about how you can save money with solar energy, because the cost of electricity today is horrendous. And again, a special thanks to Glenn for doing all of the support here of Joy of Paper. With one of the things I love that he talks about Red Cross, and of course the Red Cross, there's been so many disasters lately that and I'm sure that if you have a chance, give some blood to the Red Cross, and they will appreciate it. Anyway, I just want to say what I always say. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, because I think her new series, and she's working hard on the third book, right here, set right here in Florida, near in our neighborhood, called Haunted Haven, and you can get her books online. And it's Carol J. Perry, and the series is Haunted Haven, and she's busy working on book three already. Just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful author. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And I appreciate everything you do for me. And everybody have a wonderful, wonderful day.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.